It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls for artists, scientists, and the community to create unique interactions and conversations. Now, today's conversation is going to focus on obtaining ethically sourced and sustainable spices from around the world, as well as the stories of farmers who produce them. On the show with me today is Claire Cheney, who's the founder and owner of Curio Spice. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I have Susan Turner, who's the graphic and events manager at Curio Spice. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
And we have Josh Mamaclay, who's the marketing and engagement manager for Curio Spice.
Hi, Josh. Hey there. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. It's getting a little more fallish here, so it's nice. But I want to really kind of, Claire, start with, you really had a vision and a dream to do something with ethically and sustainable, not just food, but spices specifically, and you traveled. And tell us a little bit about how did Curio Spice even get started?
Well, a long time ago. No, I started it 6 years ago, and I actually started it out of a passion for a very specific spice, and that spice is saffron. I was doing research for a writing project about the history and modern day usage of saffron, and I had traveled to northern Greece to take part in the saffron harvest and was completely blown away, not only by the beauty, but the aromas of fresh saffron. It's a flower, it's a crocus. And I thought to myself, I want to learn more about spices and where they come from and what plants they come from and who these people are that grow it and have been doing so for thousands of years. So that project, you know, had a lot of twists and turns, but eventually I decided to move to Southeast Asia and do more traveling and now have a spice business as a result. So it's been a real adventure. But
where were you in Southeast Asia?
I was based in Bangkok, Thailand, and it's a great hub for traveling to both South Asia, so parts of India and Sri Lanka, and then Cambodia, Vietnam, Indonesia. And it was quite delicious, I must say.
Yeah. I mean, that part of the region, it's just known for the diversity of food.
It is. I didn't make it to the Philippines, where Josh's family is from. And, you know, I hope to get back and visit there because I've now become a little obsessed with Filipino cuisine. But yeah, it's just remarkable, the kind of spectrum of flavors that come from that region.
So when you thought about starting a business in spices, I mean, I know one of your goals was really to how do you promote and help, you know, local, not local there, but local in the region where the spice is grown. How do you ethically do that and that kind of thing? So what have you learned in the process of doing that?
That it's really hard. I mean, you know, ethically sourced spices make up a tiny, tiny drop in the ocean of spices that are traded around the world. So we're really trying to disrupt the commodity spice market that is dominated by some very big brands. And the major challenge with, you know, small farms, and particularly with spices, is that they're most often grown by smallholder farmers. So, you know, one or two people growing a little plot of land with their spice, and then they're selling that spice to a buyer, and most often a middle person. Mm-hmm. And then there's 10 other middlemen along the way that kind of reduce the value of the spice. So we are working to get, you know, to change that and really just directly source from the farmer and be able to highlight the incredible fresh flavor, because now we've cut out a lot of time taken up by all those middlemen, and also been able to help the farmer get a much better price. So it's what's, you know, it's not a new model. It's what's happened in coffee and chocolate. And I have a background in coffee in particular. So I learned a lot about how farmers can really be uplifted by buyers who are interested in really high quality specialty products. So we buy from smallholder farmers around the world. And sometimes it takes a long time. I started a supply chain inquiry with a women's cooperative in Ethiopia over 2 years ago. And I think most people would have given up, frankly. It took so long.
You almost did.
I think Susan and Josh, you know, saw me or heard me cursing a lot and getting a little frustrated. But these supply chains from smaller producers take a long time. So
I would think a part of that's trust, right?
Absolutely.
You have to build trust. They've had a lack of that. I mean, Westerners have exploited them as well as people in their own area. I think building trust is when you live here and you're trying to deal with somebody somewhere else. Do you use a middle person or somebody at least to make the contact? Or do you use directly?
Definitely. It depends. Every place is different. With Ethiopia, I was in contact with a number of people before actually traveling to Origin, and I went with my family and actually went to this small village where this women's cooperative, it's called Banga in southwestern Ethiopia. And yes, we had lots of, you know, fixers along the way to try and help us coordinate transport. And we were with my 2-year-old daughter at the time, and we get to the airport in Banga, or just outside Banga, and they had a van ready for us because we had a translator with us. We had a crew, and I was like, okay, let's get the car seat in the van. And there were no seat belts, so there was no way to attach.
Oh no.
I shouldn't like let my grandparents, like Lyndon's grandparents, hear this, but basically we were trying to explain to them, hey, we need some way to tie the car seat down or else it's a completely pointless apparatus. So we have this like crazy rope and they're tying it to the roof and like tying it in, and it was just amusing. And I'm trying to explain, okay, if the van flips over, let's say, and you know, who cares what happens to us, but my child.
At least it wasn't on the back of a motorcycle. So.
Well, yeah. That's true. That's true. Yeah. But everything was fine. The van never flipped over.
And then, that's really a great story. Go ahead, Susan.
It just varies too, the stories and the connections, because the connection to the farm in Sicily where we get, and that trip was very different. And that came from a Southeast Asian connection, didn't it, Claire?
It did.
Yeah.
An engagement connection, I think. It's a great story.
Yeah, that story is, I was hiking up a volcano in Bali, of all places, because why not? And little did I know that my then boyfriend was about to propose, but we were hiking with this other couple that were Sicilian, and we became really good friends with them. And years later, we ended up going to visit them in Sicily. And going to this farm. So it was this kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And you kind of, I've got Greece in there, you've got Sicily in there, you've got East in there. How about India?
Oh, India.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Have any of you been to India?
No, not yet.
And I mean, I don't talk from very much experience. I've only been once for a few weeks, but it is a wild place. It's a wild place. It is so colorful and so noisy and so stimulating that it just really tests you as a traveler. And I'm really happy I went. I got to see some incredible spice history in action. I mean, India is just a treasure trove of beautiful spices.
That's really, I mean, it's really nice to follow, that you really kind of followed Spice Road at different ways. And you know, that road still exists in terms of a different way, but it's not just spices that I've traveled at, but cultural exchanges and that little thing. So,
That's one of the things that I really love about this business is the window that it gives me into the history of food. So it's, I think I've told you this story before, but like horchata, which is a favorite of mine when you go to a taqueria, and realizing that that beverage has such deep history, actually all the way back to Egypt, but certainly through the, you know, new quote unquote new world conquest from Spain, and then and Arab conquest of Spain.
And the cinnamon in horchata is actually Sri Lankan in origin. It's a sweet cinnamon that first botanically grew in Sri Lanka and then made its way through Europe and then over to Mexico, and is now sort of the signature cinnamon of Mexico, which is different than the quote unquote signature spice, I mean, cinnamon of the US, which is Vietnamese cinnamon.
Yes.
So yeah, and there's, go ahead, Susan.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's just, to me, that is almost magical. Just, it just has so much resonance that you can bring these ancient byways and food ways like into your own kitchen. To me, that's just like, it's almost religious.
Absolutely.
100%.
It's just connection.
And that fits in your role, right? I mean, part of what you do with graphics and Josh helps with some of the marketing, but you were doing a lot of that. You were doing classes that you were helping to construct. And so I know that from, and we'll get listeners to go to your website, but the thing is, on your website too, you have some of that information that's beyond what the spice is used for. You have a little bit of the story. Susan, when you try to represent all this, you're trying to represent something that has this color and smell, and you're trying to do it on a two-dimensional. How do you do that?
Color mostly. And I really want to take, I really feel the limitation of sensory description so profoundly, and have thought about, you know, working with like maybe taking a wine class or something, just to get more comfortable in that, because it's, you know, delicious only goes so far.
Yeah,
right. And I think that you're following along, you know, what brewers are doing and the wine industry, and also in the graphic design, right, and the naming. And so you don't have to, Claire, I know you don't have to name a spice we know like cinnamon. However, when you do a blend, then you get to be very creative in what you call it. And how's that happen? Is that collaboration among all of you? Everybody's working, or who comes up with these great names?
It's definitely fun when we have a new blend and we're all like around the office. We had a celery salt, for example, that just came out, and Josh is on his computer looking up like all these words.
Literally anything in reference to its Latin name or other roots in which this spice blend can be found. Mm-hmm. We're looking up synonyms for what we can describe the flavor with.
Yeah.
And that was a solid, I think, like 45-minute process of just out thinking out loud in the office amongst all of us. And you know, we ended up falling onto who made that very specific blend in the office, which was our production manager, Caitlin. So we just kind of blurted out, what if we just name it after Caitlin? Caitlin yeah. Celery Salt. Yeah. And it stuck. And yeah. and obviously we ran down and asked her permission. Hey, do you mind if your name is on the packaging for these hundreds of yeah. of jars of celery salt? And thankfully she was very okay with it. And
well, you have to tell the part about how she said maybe we should use a
stage name.
A stage yeah. name.
Yeah, she I think we had we had put forth perhaps we call it Margot's Celery Salt, and you know, Caitlin definitely got a really good kick out of that and is now
because she was like, Caitlin is so boring. You guys should pick a more interesting name. And we were like, Caitlin, that's your name. Yeah.
And she's a real person. I'm a big fan of the originals, Anthony Bourdain thing. Yeah. And I was listening to him and it was really hilarious talking about things like Betty Crocker, who didn't, you know, who wasn't a real person. But everybody
knows
this
brand. Is a real person. Nancy Drew.
But right. But I mean, I think that's the great thing. You can invent a name. You can invent, you know, somebody who's doing something and add it to that. And it's a way of what you were saying, Susan, of creating excitement around something that you really can't. We don't have smell-o-vision, so we really can't.
Right.
You know, we have to get it. We have to go in the shop, or we have to buy it and then smell it. Yeah. So description. As well as pictures and what you're doing, Josh, and then just having fun when you stick, I think that playfulness that you guys have. So spices really are this cross between art and science. I mean, there's the whole culinary art, the whole idea of color and flavor and smell. And then there's on top of that, the whole science of how we get it and where we get it from. And so Susan, you started with saffron. Can you tell us a little bit? That is really complicated to get, and that's why it's so expensive. So tell us a little more about how that is actually created.
How saffron is grown.
Yeah, how's saffron created?
Yeah, so it is, again, a crocus. So those, you know, in the springtime when you see the first purple little blooms come out of the snowy ground, at least if you live in a place with snow, it's very beautiful. And so those aren't necessarily saffron crocus, but it's the same family. So they're a little bulb. And the saffron, the spice itself, is the stigma, the female part of the flower. So there's the stigma and the stamen. The stamen have no value. Sorry, guys.
And they really don't because the saffron, is sterile.
There yeah, that's true.
So
yeah.
The only way that you can reproduce saffron is cloning kind of the bulbs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome. Sterile female plant.
It's yeah. like all about, you know, women taking over the world, amen. Starting with saffron. That's also the cool thing when I was doing my research is that back in the Minoan age, 3500 BCE, so Stonehenge, we're talking Stonehenge era, but in Greece, there's a depiction, talk about art and science too, on frescoes depicting women harvesting saffron and offering it to a saffron goddess.
Oh, yes.
Who's attended by these blue monkeys, and scholars have no idea what this fresco means. They've all, you know, because of, there was no written record, just these paintings.
Awesome.
And yeah, when Susan said it's a religious experience, I definitely had this sort of religious experience seeing the painting and making the connection between saffron being this spice that comes from the female part of the flower and this history of women harvesting it. It's believed to be actually, there is some efficacy in the relationship between saffron and women's ailments like PMS and menstrual disorders. So there is some
being studied for depression as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and there's a relationship obviously with spices and health,
right.
in all kinds of different ways. Yeah. And I think modern medicine is beginning to discover some of those advantages of certain, you know, things that are less inflammatory or that.
Right.
So that's interesting. So you've got this little tiny flower. I mean, a crocus is pretty small. And then you got a really even tinier part inside that.
Yeah, it looks like a like a thread. An eyelash or a thread. Yeah. And there's only three. There's only three saffron stigma threads per flower. So it takes about 10,000 flowers to make 1 pound of saffron. So that's like a football field.
Oh my just to goodness.
Make a pound. Wow. Like think about like a pound of coffee in your house, you know, like it's a tiny bag of
or a pound of cherries. It's just like on such a different scale.
Pound of bricks. Yeah. Pound bricks. I know. Yeah, it's and so it's super labor intensive, and that's why it's the most valuable spice in the world.
And right, and I was going to say, there's no way they've trained a robot to do this one yet.
No,
it's just too fragile, and being able to detect it, and
yeah, so there's a flower with your thumb and your forefinger, and you kind of pinch it so that the petals come off. But then the stamens have to be separated from the stigma, and that takes another long process. It's just real arduous.
Yeah, and you don't want any of that cross-contamination. I mean, you don't want the...
You don't want those...
You don't want those guys involved. Right, because it needs to remain sterile. That's just... Yeah. And then are those dry? Do they go through a process?
Okay. They're very slowly dried, dehydrated, or sun-dried.
Wow.
And then, so let's go through the calendar. The bulbs are planted in the summertime, July. Then the saffron flowers are harvested in October. And then by January, they are dried and it's time to start separating the flowers, the stigma, stamen. Great. So it's not until the spring, really, that the finished spice is ready to sell.
So that adds to the cost too. It's like a year long thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I was just actually speaking with a guy who owns a shop that I get my vacuum fixed. And he is, he's Armenian of Persian descent, and his family still owns property in Iran. So he is back and forth a couple of times a year to check on this property. And he was, as all Iranians are, just almost, like, talk about a sacred spice. I mean, saffron is just absolutely adored and revered. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that this saffron in Iran is actually, it has been producing about 80% of the world's supply of saffron, and it's very, very fine. They have very high standards. But the saffron growing in Iran is really going down now because government is not supporting farmers whatsoever. Farmers are just not planting it. It's also a generational thing, and it's also climate change. Areas are, the water supply is really, really changing. So, it's like a canary in a coal mine. It's a thing that you can look at to see the health of a culture and of a society, as well, you know, the political and economic health, as well as, things, climate change and...
Yeah.
And that agricultural bit is actually, I think, for most of us here at Curio have spent time working on farms and or in the culinary world in one way or another, and just recognizing that the work that farmers do. Yeah. And so Claire's made that actually part of our, that idea is part of our mission of supporting farmers very directly and realizing how critical they are to our survival.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you were just going down a path that I think is really important for people to understand, and that agriculture has always been about predictability. We've had whole civilizations disappear of people because of climate change. I mean, before we've had as large a human caused one that we have now, but prior to that, there were changes in local climates. And it could wipe a population completely out, or at least they would migrate. Now, you just said, Claire, it's a year-long process. It has seasons. It goes through these with the unpredictability. I would think this is just going to make, particularly something as fragile as a spice, and it's so precise. Same way, probably with coffee too. I mean, there's a tolerance range, and we're going to see a very complicated thing for particularly the farmers you're working with to be able to predict their seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also why the smallholder farmer model is really powerful, because around the world, especially in the tropical regions, a lot of the smallholder spice farmers are also growing a commodity crop like rice or sugarcane or something. And they need the extra income from these spices in order to, you know, supplement their income. Because if the rice, you know, it's a bad year for rice or you know, the main crop that they're growing suffers, they need that extra income. So, you know, we're also aware of the regions that play is taking place, and it's becoming, we did some work with the UNDP, the UN Development Program, and they are in particular looking at species of plants that are more resilient to change. And I'll be interested to see, you know, how spices play into that. And, you know, back to the survival concept, while those spices aren't necessarily nutritionally valuable for the farmers in terms of just like putting food on the table, they do provide very valuable income. So that is something we're aware of and hoping to continue to support.
And another challenge facing those farmers coming down the pike is in climate change is ocean rise, because so many spices are grown in coastal or island environments. So that's a real concern.
And a lot of their the crops you were talking about, rice and others, were grown in low areas intentionally. And so the increase of flooding, but particularly the influx of salt water, is a real problem. So you're right. I mean, the flooding isn't necessarily flooding from rain. It can be, but it can also be from a storm surge that brings something ashore on these coastal areas. And you start getting a lot of salt infiltration, and that can be another disaster to a lot of growing and plants. So it makes sense, Claire, that they would be doing that. We're talking with Claire Cheney, Susan Turner, and Josh Mamaclay about obtaining ethically sourced, sustainable spices from around the world. But we also, when we come back, I want to have a little bit more conversation about, you know, how you pair spices and how you figure that out to make a blend and all that kind. And so please join us when we come back after a short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation with Claire Cheney, Susan Turner, and Josh Mamaclay about spices. And before the break, I kind of queued up that I wanted to talk, Claire, about you invented, really, to help us, and I have it on my refrigerator, this cool spice wheel that really does help me to figure out things, because that for me is really complicated. And particularly, I would think when you get into doing that, Josh, I know in the Philippines, that's a whole different than cultural twist on the spice. And so for me, spices from around the world and cooking in different cuisines is really tricky, because I don't know how much sometimes I'll learn Italian food. How much am I putting in? I get it. But then I try to then cook something from somewhere else. So Claire, how have you helped us to try to, because you really have, to simplify that process?
Well, yeah. So you mentioned the spice wheel, which has become a very important tool in my teaching and also just in my own process of understanding how to layer spices. I had, a flavor wheel I didn't invent it. I became familiar with flavor wheels in coffee. That was really important in specialty coffee, both for good flavors and also bad flavors. And then I also did some study with a natural perfumer named Mandy Eftel, and there's a perfume wheel that she used that I was very inspired by. And it helps in many ways. One, by just creating visual cues that can be familiar. So on our spice wheel, the red section, for example, is the hot spices. So a lot of the spices that create kind of hot sensations, the chilies, the peppercorns, and even kind of ginger, those family members. And then the green section, so literal green section is herbs, you know, and
cooling
spices, aromatic spices. So that's one element, is really just starting to understand where do spices fit. You know, some people might not think about the fact that ginger is hot. You know, they might just think it's gingery. but when you eat a piece of raw ginger or dry ginger, there is definite heat in that. And then it's about the relative weight and intensity of spices. And that's the trickier part. And that actually I learned a lot when I was in perfume, because there is this analogy to music. So the idea of a low note having kind of low bass notes, resonance, versus a high note, which is like the soprano section, which can be kind of accenting and frilly on the top. And that works really well with scent, because, you know, I think there's probably science to this that I'm not able to describe accurately, but, you know, the kind of frequency at which aromatic molecules move and interact with each other. So I think about certain spices as being kind of base notes, and I sometimes call them the base layer or the earth layer, because you can also have the analogy of you know, what's in the ground, very like heavy earth notes. And then you have kind of the middle notes, which are, I also sometimes call the bridge. So those are bridging flavors and kind of balancing.
Yeah.
They're the altos. I was always an alto. So it's just sort of blending in. And then you have the garnish notes, or the top notes, and those are the sopranos I mentioned earlier. And those are kind of what you put in last. So you have the base notes, which you start in your cooking, and you fry those in oil, or you steep those in a broth. And then later on in the recipe, you add your middle notes or your bridge. And then at the end of the recipe, you put some hot chili flakes on there, or you sprinkle on some rose petals. And then the other key element are the unifiers. And I don't have a good musical analogy necessarily for that.
Percussion?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Or, you know, when...
the harmony?
The conductor.
The string section. The conductor, yeah.
Sure.
We can work this out. but the unify spices are ones that you can add to recipes to smooth out rough edges and help marry flavors. So I consider fennel, coriander, and cumin to be unifying spices. They help amalgamate other flavors, because there's just such a huge variety, and sometimes they're out of balance, and that's what's really hard about spices is balancing. So
don't you think that a spice like cumin, part of the reason it functions that way is because its flavor is so complex and so comprehensive. So it when you get a really good cumin, it has those bright high notes, it has this sort of strong backbone middle ground, and it has these earthy base qualities. So it can talk to
it's the person at the party that is just like talk to anyone, like, you know, very outgoing,
and it can help other people actually have a conversation.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
And so I think that may be why. And in if you were to take it in color terms, your tertiary colors, like if you have, you know, that neutral kind of pale khaki kind of cafe au lait color that's very popular in decorating right now.
Yeah.
It has been for like 10 years.
Yes.
One of the reasons that works so well is that's a tertiary color. It has red, blue, and yellow, and almost equal portions.
It's a good call.
Yeah.
So that if you put a red accent with it,
it works.
It works.
Yeah.
If the light changes across the day, it's going to shift in terms of how you perceive that color, warm, cool.
And it, coriander has that too.
It yeah, just, absolutely.
It just, with the citrusy quality as
it
well.
Just gets along with everybody. Mm. And, you know, that's also why it's such a hard color to match at the paint store, is because it's very precisely equal, kind of equal or slightly unequal parts.
Yeah, I love this idea of balance. And, you know, you're balancing a lot of complicated things. So one, you're balancing your smell. You're balancing your taste. You're also balancing touch, because there is taste, but then there's also touch from the fire. You know, the fire part is beyond taste. It's a,
yeah,
it's
the a sensation. Touch.
You can even have it on your skin. You can feel it.
Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You sure can.
And so you're really balancing all those senses, all, and then, you know, you've got all that going on. And I love this, the idea of a symphony or in music as an analogy, because really, honestly, it's okay if somebody solos every once in a while.
Yeah.
But not all the time. And if they're in a chorus, right? And if they're in a chorus, you don't want to hear that soprano.
All the time.
You know, right. They can tend to go over the top because they're not singing together with the group. And
right.
So I think that's a really good analogy. Do spices also have that idea? I was thinking of, you know, when we think of the pH scale and we think of acid to base, do we also get some of that where one can balance another one? Can offset?
Yes, yes. Well, and that's what spice blending is all about, is understanding how to combine spices so that it's not, you're not just tasting those two spices side by side, but you're getting that transcended flavor that is rising above the individual parts. And that's where a really good spice blend can really sing, mm-hmm. to continue the metaphor, and create a wonderful combination of flavors that you can't necessarily identify any single one. But you can identify a pleasing harmony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our chili blend, for example, our chili today spice mix, which somebody was just packing this morning, so it's top of mind, is a very approachable spice mix. It's very American. It's kind of the familiar blend of ancho chili and cumin and Mexican oregano. But we add in, for example, Turkish urfa chili, which is a very sweet, chocolatey, sultry spice, and it works so well in this blend because it actually helps marry those flavors of the ancho and the cumin, and creates a really delicious, right. harmonious flavor.
I have to say, before Claire started doing this,
Susan was anti-spice blend.
I was.
Really?
I really, really was. Because they're so often so plodding.
They're
and so dumb. They're just like...
There's so much garbage out there.
Well, it's
frankly.
Just like...
It's true.
Well, there is. Okay. It's like somebody, okay, these might be good. We'll just stuff them together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's just like, if it Italian seasoning, it's just 1, 2, 3. Hello.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't need that. I have spices and I have herbs in my cupboard. I just, thank you. And then I tell our customers that it's just such a revelation. Claire's, it's really visible. All the threads that have come together to make this business, it's there in those blends.
Thanks, Susie.
Poetic. They're very nuanced. They're very, but they have a backbone, they have a personality. And to me, one of the markers, many of our blends, what's really amazing is you can use them in savory or sweet settings with a great deal of success. And it just goes to a well-made blend has this versatility.
Like the sweet and salty pepitas with the chili today. That's really good.
Yeah.
Josh, what was your relationship to spice mixes? I'm curious now.
Yeah, I mean, my relationship to spice mixes was really just finding what's in my parents' pantry and tasting it and being a little disappointed in it.
Yeah.
Just like you said, there's a lot of garbage out there. But I think what's really neat, especially having kind of gone through the wheelhouse of culinary school and the restaurant world. And honestly, culinary instruction is what's really, really, really well done here is understanding the roles and the jobs that each individual spice can play. Mm. And I think we've done a really good job illustrating that in the flavor wheel, and we do a really good job of being aware of that in the spice blends. Like you were saying with the chili today, you know, we have a fairly familiar blend, but we're thinking about the flavors that go into it and what other spices can play along with those flavors, but also play the same role as some of those flavors. And, you know, when we were talking about who's what part in the symphony that is spices, like yeah. that awareness is something that, you know, I think we're really inspired by and find a lot of fun in. You know, what I witness here whenever we're blending is like, oh, it's kind of part laboratory, part playground. It's mm-hmm. it's really both, like you, what you said, Mark, an art and a science.
Well, and Josh has been doing these great spice tastings yep. on Instagram, where he goes through our library and picks yeah. different pure spices or different blends. But yeah. I find it really eye-opening, because you're taking that moment and spending kind of that one-on-one time with that flavor and explore, because like there's just infinite numbers mm-hmm. of pathways you can go down.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's that infinite number of pathways that some consumers might find super intimidating.
Yeah.
You know, like it's right now we're sitting in the spice room and we're sitting amongst easily 100 or so different containers filled with spices. I can imagine a customer is like, there's too many to try. I don't know what to do. So I kind of do that for them. I will yeah. grab a handful of spices, eat them straight up, and tell you exactly what I'm experiencing and what kind of foods I think they could play with. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that inspires others to be just as playful with their food and
yeah.
and
explore. I really like that idea, as you guys have returned to having customers coming in and hopefully can keep doing that. But the thing is, I could almost see you being like a tasting room for wine mm-hmm. because of all the notes in wine. You know how complicated it can be. You really have to taste it and get a sense of that. And so I'm sure part of what you've always done is smell, even if you're able to smell it, get that.
Right.
But I mean, I think having little small tasters of something, that's a really great idea, Josh. I mean, that makes some sense in terms of me helping to find a spice. Much harder to do online. Claire, one thing you mentioned that I wanted to follow up on was, we call them spices. However, they're all over a range. There's
yes.
There's herbs that are sometimes, they're leafy. There's things that yep. are seeds. There's things that are some from root. I mean, we use all parts yep. of a plant and then we call it a spice, but really yep. they're kind of all over the place, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. Like, what is a spice?
Yeah.
So I mean,
one of those stoner questions.
What is this? Well, I generally define it as any aromatic plant part that
Got
is
it.
Dry. So yeah, like fresh basil, not a spice, but dried basil is a spice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think calling some spices herbs is fine. But yeah, there's barks, there's the saffron stigma flower, there's vanilla pods, which
orris
is the,
yeah.
there's orris root, which is a super unusual, rhizome of an iris mm-hmm. from Morocco,
right.
you know, so, and you know, we're not going to necessarily be like, oh no, these are rhizomes, not spices, but, yeah, it is a term that gets tossed around, and particularly because when you say something is spicy, it doesn't, that's confusing because mm-hmm. that often means it's hot. But so I try to, you know, coach our team to say this is spice forward mm-hmm. mm-hmm. to mean that it has a lot of spice flavor as opposed to being hot. So dried
yeah,
aromatic plant parts.
Yeah, I think what you just said is really important, because I get kind of annoyed when people say, ask me the question when I'm cooking something, is it spicy?
Right.
Well, yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Are you meaning, is it hot and going to burn my throat? Or do you mean, is it, you know, I don't know what they mean. And often I think they are meaning that they don't want it to cause gastrointestinal problems for them.
Right. Right. It is comfort.
Yeah.
Right. It's comfort. But you know, I learned in Indian cooking, I've done a lot of Indian cooking, and it's, you know, it is intended to be spicy, but spicy is not meaning that it's hot or that it's going to burn your mouth.
It's spice forward.
Yeah, very much. That is so great. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the ways to select spices using Claire's Amazing Spice Wheel. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about is just, it's obviously a business. So you've got the front end that we talked about, which is working with farmers and sustainability and all that. And then the middle part of it, which is the core part of it, is how is it used? How do I cook with it? How do I do that? But then on the other side, there's this whole side of how do I let people know what they can do? And you're, like you said, you're sitting and I'm seeing these big, giant kind of cans full of spices around you. Mm-hmm. It could be intimidating seeing 100 spices. And so how do you all help people navigate all that?
You know, a lot of what people really enjoyed about coming to our, and continue to enjoy about coming to our store, is the opportunity to get up close and personal with a lot of these spices. And that is definitely something that works for people who are nearby. But being able to convey that high touch experience of seeing, smelling, and tasting the spices is a lot harder once you start talking on a national scale. So that's where, you know, telling people exactly the story behind each spice becomes really, really important. And like you mentioned earlier, we're touching on little factoids and historical bits and processing information for all of our products on the website. But to further that story is really, really reliant on digging into the how special this specific spice is, whether it be it's coming from this very particular farm with this very particular set of standards and growing practices, or it's coming from this area of the world where people don't typically look to for spices. Mm. For example, like I'm thinking right off the top of my head, is it Illinois that grows saffron?
Yeah.
Yeah, like you could find American saffron. You can find, we just recently got a sample of salt from the Philippines, actually, to try out a different fleur de sel, as well as a different form of salt making that's almost extinct at this point, that involves passing Filipino seawater through burnt coconut ashes to purify it, and then letting it solidify in this clay vase.
That's so cool.
It's so neat. We got it literally forms an egg of salt, and the only way to get it out is to break it open. Mm. You know, we're exploring different methods of preparing foods out there in the world that, you know, could very well use a bigger highlight. Mm. And it's these kind of important stories that really, you know, I'll be honest with you, kind of draw people in to what we're doing. And then once they see, oh, not only are they finding these really, really cool, unique spices and salts and processes out there, but they're also individually helping those people that make them, I think that plays then into not only is this special, but it is doing better for the world. And, you know, our status as a benefit corporation has been really, really guiding in how we go about all of this business. Mm-hmm. And I think especially in today's world where the power of the ethical dollar is at a very, very high peak, people want to support businesses that are doing that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, it's just that especially the pandemic has highlighted so many issues around the globe. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to spend your dollar on something that's making a difference, I think is even more meaningful lately.
Yeah.
So
and that it gives you, you know, you said earlier, Claire, you know, it doesn't give you, the spice doesn't give you what you have to have.
Right.
It does for the person selling it, but what I mean, or growing it.
Right.
But it doesn't, but we've never been without that art part of it.
Yeah.
In other words, it makes eating fun. Or it
does, and joy is so important. And,
right.
You know, like when I see Susan and Joss prep for a recipe photography shoot, talk about joy everywhere, because they're getting out all these props and they're getting out the spices and they're styling the food. And, you know, the team is around being like, oh, is there going to be leftover of that? And it's what we want to have happen in everyone's kitchen.
Exactly.
At home, is like that feeling of curiosity and those moments of joy that come from these really unique ingredients that, yeah, we don't need to survive, but
right. But
in a way we do, because they keep us alive.
And they do. There's a lot more to survive. There's a lot more to what you're talking about. A lot more to survival than just really just the nutrition, the science, nutrition. There's more, way more to it.
Yeah,
I would say too that one of the pieces of who we are and how we are that is a very welcoming into what can be an overwhelming experience. And an analogy I like to use is a very gifted performer like Yo-Yo Ma, let's say, who invites you as the audience into the music. Mm-hmm. So he's beyond talented and virtuosic, but he's not there to show you that. He's there to show you the music and to say, come, look at this. Is this beautiful or what? And so we have that way. And I think it's our voice. And the other thing that people have dealing with customer service over the holidays last year that I've heard time and again was the relief that people feel when they find that that is a true thing. It's not just our corporate mission.
Right.
It's how we behave all the way through the process or any interaction. So whether that's saying, oh, you know what I did with this last week that was so good and it's hardly even a recipe, it's just do this, this, and this, or whether it's like, well, what do you like to cook? Mm-hmm. You know, tell me what you like to cook. What do you like to eat? And I can maybe help you. And so it's just making this without being precious about it, without being, this is our secret knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, come in. This is an amazing thing. And you're going to have so much fun in here.
That's such a good comparison with Yo-Yo Ma. I think, you know, we're all very excited about food here. I don't think there's a single person in this company that is not excited
and
about
different
the
eater.
We don't have anybody, everyone here, I think, lives to eat, doesn't eat to live.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so when we get that opportunity to share that excitement, whether it be in person, online, or really anywhere, it's that moment when the light bulb goes off and you see that they're just as excited about it as you are. That's really, really, really rewarding.
Especially because the restaurant world shut down for so long during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And
I know
that special experience of going out to eat and having somebody take care of you and create something beautiful and unusual got taken away. So there was this opportunity for us to, obviously we're not recreating restaurant experiences per se, but we're still bringing something special that's out of, you know, because life can get kind of mundane when you're having to cook every night, and if you're feeding a family, it can be exhausting. So
we've been really fortunate to hear from a number of customers, like quite a number of customers, who've taken the time to write to us and say, or come in once they'd come back to the shop and said, you were such an important part of me making it through sane. And I had so much fun because it's like we have a recipe for vegetarian chili with the chili today. Super simple, super approachable, unbelievable flavor, just based on that one blend and then a topping of some smoky pickled onions. And
yeah, I love that recipe.
So it's really it's just really a way of saying, come on in, try this. And it's like, you know what it's going to be. It's going to be a bowl of chili. And then you taste it and it's like, oh boy, that's good.
Yeah.
And
now, something that you all do, and you do it really well, and you know, it's in your mix of things that you try to encourage people how to use a spice or learn, but you use non-chefs. In other words, you use people that really cook well to do a class. So, I mean, they're not high-end chefs. They might be, you know, chefing in a restaurant. But what I mean is they're not the high end that we see on a lot of the cooking shows, to where I think, oh, that's impossible. I'm getting somebody who makes me feel like I could do that. I could work with that. Yeah. And they don't make it too complicated. The recipes aren't too complicated, but they're very flavorful and they get me introduced to it. And so I think you all have gifts in what you're doing, not only from the sustainability and the ethics, but I think you really are giving us a gift and have during COVID. So I want to thank Claire Cheney, Susan Turner, and Josh Mamaclay for participating in our conversation about spices. We'll put up a link so that you can get to Curio Spice, as well as to be able to purchase their Claire's Amazing Spice Wheel. And I'm just wanted to end it with just saying that, you know, during this time with COVID, where we don't know, it's unknown, it's just really nice to sometimes just hunker down and take a recipe and order something from you guys and then just see what it does. And I love that. And so until next week, I'm reminding you to tune in as we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.